As Gary mentioned, we will be looking at Mark chapter 4, verses 35 through 41 this morning, the passage he read just moments ago. So if you have a Bible and you're not turned there, if you can go ahead and turn there, that would be good. Do you ever have morbid daydreams about different ways of dying? I sometimes imagine what it would be like. And the one that makes me really shudder is drowning. I think of the Anabaptist martyrs who were killed by drowning for their biblical fidelity regarding church and baptism. What a scary way that would be to go. And they were drowned in lakes and rivers. And if it's even possible, I think it would be even scarier to drown in the ocean. Think of sailors over the centuries whose ships have gone down, maybe in a storm, maybe in naval warfare, set adrift in the roiling waves. What a scary, dark, cold way to go. Now, can you imagine how these disciples felt in this passage as their little vessel took on water in that great storm on the Sea of Galilee? That very fate was only moments away from them. As we hear, you can hear the terror in their voices in verse 38. Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? How did we get here? Well, up to this point in Mark chapter 4, we've seen Jesus teaching the crowds. And as verse 1 tells us, he got into a boat by the shore to have some space to address the crowds as they were on the shore. This teeming throng of people that has come to see him. And he's been speaking to them in parables, which is a teaching tool that illustrates spiritual reality with concrete pictures from everyday life. Now, the parables, and also the audience's response to the parables, have pointed toward a major theme, that is, different ways of listening to Jesus, different ways of hearing him, different attitudes. There are some who are outsiders who hear his parables, and they don't understand, and they don't care to learn more. On the other hand, there are others, including Jesus' disciples, who we might call insiders, those who care enough to ask Jesus for more light and more clarity, and he gives it to them. He explains it to them. So all of that, the whole discourse of parables, closed at verse 34, and now here, starting in verse 35 and spanning all the way through chapter 5, we have a series of three demonstrations of Jesus' power over various enemy forces. The problems that he addresses will vary in these three passages, but the takeaway will be similar for all of them. And Lord willing, over the next three Sundays, we're going to see each one. Now, the setting for our passage, as you've seen, is a storm on the Sea of Galilee. The narrative left off in verse 1. Again, Jesus is in a boat. And so in verse 35, after a day of teaching, it says, on that day when evening had come, he said to them, let us go across to the other side. Jesus probably wants to get away from the crowds and get a little bit of rest. It's tiring to teach all day, I can only imagine. He's already in the boat, so he asks the disciples, can we set out for the other side of the sea? And so they do, leaving the crowd, verse 36. They took him with them in the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. But then in verse 37, a storm strikes. A great windstorm arose, it says, and the waves were breaking into the boat so that the boat was already filling. And this brings up the conflict that drives really the rest of the story. And the main point of all we're going to see is this. Jesus rules unruly nature, so do not fear, only believe. That's the main point of the passage. That's the main point of what we're going to see this morning. Jesus rules unruly nature, so do not fear, only believe. And we're going to unpack that statement in three stages. And like a dismal report card, it's three F's, okay? Three stages, three F's. The first one is a fact. First stage is a fact. Jesus rules unruly nature. Jesus rules unruly nature. That is a fact. We see unruly nature here in the form of a violent storm, which threatens to kill everyone on board, including Jesus himself. Now, why is nature unruly? We as readers of the Bible know that ultimately it's a fruit of a fallen, cursed, and groaning world. When Adam sinned, God responded by cursing not only mankind, but all of creation. And so we know that creation groans, and things like violent storms is one form of that. But to really understand the effect of what Jesus does in this passage, we need to understand how the first century Jews here would understand the sea, what they would think about the sea. And in short, the sea was a place of chaos, disorder, and terror. Now, this is the Sea of Galilee, which is a bit of a misnomer. It's actually a big lake, but it is a stormy place, and it can be every bit as dangerous as the real sea. You can drown in it. Your boat can go under in it, just as in the real sea. So the effect is the same here. It's pure danger. Now, this stretches all the way back to the second verse of the Bible. Now, after God had created the raw materials of heaven and earth back in Genesis 1:1, we're told in the next verse what it was like. In verse 2, it says, "The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters." So there's this picture. The first thing that was created was this great formless sea. And that idea of formless is it was disordered. It was unruly and chaotic. And over the next 6 days, what we see is God gradually bringing order and organization to his creation and filling each realm with life. We see him separating the waters from the sky. We see him separating the waters with land in between them. And then we see him populating each realm with life. He is ordering and filling his creation. But it doesn't end there. Generations later, just as we've heard in recent weeks with Greg's preaching in Genesis, when the earth has been filled with violence and corruption, what does God use to destroy all mankind, all life, save Noah's family and those on the ark? It's a deluge of waters. And against the backdrop of how God created in Genesis 1:1, or Genesis all of chapter 1, the flood is in a real sense a decreation and recreation. The earth goes back underwater, back under that disorder and chaos, empties out all of the life, and then starts anew when the waters recede and the passengers get off the ark. So essentially the ocean takes over the whole world in the ark. The sea envelops the whole world, only then for God to bring it back in control. But that's not the end of it. All throughout the Old Testament, you see, especially in poetic passages, the sea is used to represent a dangerous, unruly enemy that terrifies man and that God alone can control and subdue. And one of the best places to see this is Psalm 107, verses 23 to 30. Now, it's kind of a longer passage, but I'm going to read the whole thing because it so well pictures this peril of the sea, but also God's sovereign rule over it. Psalm 107, verses 23 to 30. "Some went down to the sea in ships, doing business on the great waters. They saw the deeds of the Lord, his wondrous works in the deep. For he commanded and raised the stormy wind, which lifted up the waves of the sea. They mounted up to heaven. They went down to the depths. Their courage melted away in the evil plight. They reeled and staggered like drunken men and were at their wits' end. Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble, and he delivered them from their distress. He made the storm be still, and the waves of the sea were hushed. Then they were glad that the waters were quiet, and he brought them to their desired haven." End quote. So the sea is deeply dangerous. It's a perilous place. But the Lord himself is the power, do you notice, who both stirred up the raging storm in the sea and then, in response to his people's cries, stilled it again to protect them. He is sovereign over it from beginning to end. He's sovereign over the storms, starting them, sustaining them, and ending them. Now, if you've ever swum in the ocean, you can relate with this sense of danger, I trust. Yes, the ocean is a fun place to go and play and swim, but don't you get at least a little small feeling of danger every time you plunge into that water in the ocean. It's not like a swimming pool, is it? It's the wildest frontier we ever meet, the ocean. And you get this sense that you're going into a wild place. The sea kills many people every year, maybe hundreds, and has done for all of human history. There are sharks, which is the first thing I think of, and other sea creatures that can kill you. There are strong, violent waves that can dash you against the rocks. There are currents, there are riptides, there are cold currents, depths, and there's darkness, and there's mystery. It is a wild place. So how exactly does Jesus demonstrate his authority here over nature? Well, to answer that question, it's helpful to consider what the disciples may have been expecting when they roused him from his sleep. When they say in verse 38, so he's asleep on the stern of the boat, on a cushion, and they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Now, they might be, in a way, implicitly asking him for help in some way, but it's clear once you get down to verse 41 that they don't expect anything like what Jesus ends up doing. So what did they expect? And there are some parallels that tie this account back to the episode of the storm in the book of Jonah. You may recall in the prophet Jonah how God had given him a mission to go to the city of Nineveh with a prophetic message. And in disobedience, Jonah said, "No, I'm going to go the opposite way." Got into a boat to go across the sea, and a storm rises. And echoing this passage, or anticipating this passage, Jonah's sleeping through the storm. And the sailors come and wake him up to help. And they say, "What do you mean, you sleeper? Arise, call out to your God. Perhaps the God will give a thought to us that we may not perish." And I think that's something like what the disciples here had in mind too. "You're a man of God, a prophet, Jesus." You see how they call Jesus the title teacher in verse 38. Certainly an honorific title, but kind of a thin one, isn't it? Teacher. Okay, prophet, God sent teacher. Doesn't God listen to your prayers? He listened to the prophet Elijah's prayers and withheld rain for years. Maybe he'll listen to your prayers and save us from this storm. Maybe we have a shot if we can wake up the teacher. So this is why Jesus' action in verse 39 is so mind-blowing to the disciples. It says, "And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, 'Peace be still.' And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm." He doesn't wake up and pray. He doesn't wake up and seek help and want to talk to the manager. He doesn't wake up and consult the God who is up there, out there, who controls the wind and the waves down here. He talks to the wind. He talks to the waves. And he says, we could say more literally, "Be quiet, shut up," to the wind and the waves. And the wind and the waves obey. Now, the verbs that are translated in verse 39, rebuke and be still, these two verbs are used together back in chapter 1, verse 25, when Jesus is casting out a demon. And for that reason, because of that parallel, some interpreters think that this use of these two verbs is implying, the way he talks to the wind and the waves, that there are demonic powers behind the chaos and danger of natural disasters. Now, that idea might sound a little bit weird to us, might make us a little bit nervous. And that might be owing to our cultural location as modern Westerners. We tend to knee-jerk to scientific, material, non-supernatural explanations for everything. We tend to think in terms of science. We tend to think in terms of molecules and pressure gradients. And that's certainly true. But ancient people were much quicker to ascribe spiritual agency to phenomena in the world, like a storm. And sometimes the Bible itself confirms this. Do you remember in the book of Job when Satan gets permission to strike Job with afflictions? And God gives him permission. God, who is sovereign over all, including Satan, gives Job permission. And what does Satan permission to afflict Job. And what does Satan use? Human raiders and thieves. Fire from the sky, a great windstorm. Now, we don't really know, and whether or not demonic powers stand behind natural disasters here in Mark or elsewhere in the world, The big point is the same. God alone is Lord over all other powers. God alone is Lord over every power. And God alone talks to the wind and the waves, and they obey. And here's Jesus not asking God to help him, but doing himself what only God can do. Rule the unruly chaos of nature. You see, he's not just a man sent by God. He is that, but he's much more. He's God himself. This is the mystery of Christ's incarnation. The Son of God becomes a man. He joins the eternal divine nature to a human nature in one person. Undivided in one person. He gives up nothing of his deity, but adds to it full humanity. So the same Jesus, the same human Jesus, limited, weak, exhausted by a day of preaching, so he's sleeping in the storm, is the same Jesus who wakes up and divinely rules the storm by the word of his power. This is Jesus Christ. Philippians 2 puts it like this, that though he was in the form of God, that is the nature of God, he did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. So Paul is saying, he had the nature of God and he emptied himself not of the nature of God, but he emptied himself by adding the nature of a man. That is Jesus Christ. He didn't become anything less than fully God, yet took on full humanity, including our weakness. So the narrative presents this crucial fact about Jesus. He is the divine Son of God who rules unruly nature. But that fact isn't all that we're supposed to take away from this passage. You see, the story doesn't end at verse 39. And Jesus' interaction with his disciples shows and raises an important issue of how we're supposed to respond to this truth about Jesus. And this brings us to our second stage, our second F, which is faith. Faith. We respond by trusting him. Faith. We respond by trusting him. Verse 40. He said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" And here Jesus is giving us the moral of the story. And it comes in the form of two questions that together rebuke the disciples because of how they had rebuked him. He says, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" This is another way of saying, if you had faith, you wouldn't have been afraid of the storm. We see their fearful reaction in how they address Jesus. They rebuked him. In verse 38, they said, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Now, how does this display a lack of faith? In the disciples' defense, we might argue that it seems that they did display some measure of faith, in fact. I mean, they went to Jesus, didn't they? And it seems unlikely to me that they woke him up simply to scold him on the way to their watery death. Rather, as I said before, it seems like they were seeking his help. But it's certainly clear that they didn't expect him to command the storm itself. That's because they didn't really understand who he was and who he is. So when Jesus challenges their faith, what he's implying is that what faith is supposed to be in is him, himself. Namely, his divine identity. Of course they believe in Jesus as a man. They believe that he is a man. And of course they believe in him as a teacher, even a teacher worth following as they're doing. They believe in him as perhaps a miracle worker. They've seen him do miracles. But they fail to believe all that he is. The Son of God, who is God himself. Now we as the readers are privy to more kind of insider knowledge about this because unlike the disciples, we were at Jesus' baptism back in chapter 1, verse 11, and we heard the Father say to him from on high, "You are my beloved Son, with you I am well pleased." So we kind of have a little bit more of an answer key than the disciples did. They are seeing through a glass dimly, and it's slowly coming into clearer resolution. And digging a little deeper, what is the nature of this faith and how we come to have it? From elsewhere in Scripture, we know that saving faith in Jesus is very black and white. It's a binary thing. It's an on and off switch. You have it or you don't. You either believe and trust Him and have eternal life, or you don't and you're condemned. There are only two states. But in our experience, it can seem quite different, can it? And that's what the whole Gospel of Mark spends a lot of time developing and showing. This progressive, slow, gradual, halting nature of coming to trust in Jesus. Do you remember how the passages we've seen in recent weeks when we were in Mark 3 and 4, we've seen this issue of how you listen to Jesus draws a stark line through humanity between insiders and outsiders. There are the insiders who are sympathetic and trusting listeners versus the outsiders who are cynical and dismissive listeners. And these disciples landed on the right side of that line, the correct side of that line. They're insiders. They're on board with Jesus. Literally on this boat, they're on board with Jesus. But against that backdrop, Mark's narrative will now take a turn to focus on the weakness and indeed at times the apparent absence of their faith. This will crop up several times over the next few chapters. They've decided for Jesus, but it's still not a done deal. They're not out of the woods yet. They have to keep following. They have to keep watching. They have to keep learning who Jesus is. They've begun to see the faint shadows of the reality of who He is, but that sight needs greater resolution and clarity. And that's what Jesus will be giving them all the way to the empty tomb at the end of the Gospel of Mark. Now, earlier on in chapter 4, He told them that the outsiders who reject His parables are seeing but not perceiving and hearing but not understanding. Those are the outsiders, He said to His disciples. But later on in chapter 8, He will challenge the disciples themselves in a burst of righteous frustration. Do you not yet perceive and understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? In chapter 8, verses 17 and 18. Now, I've heard of other cultures where marriages are sometimes arranged between a man and a woman who do not meet until their wedding day. Can you imagine that? Getting married to someone and then getting to know them, finding out who they are. Now, you're committed, you're in, but then the big question is, who is this that I'm joined to? Who is this I'm committed to? And it's going to be quite a journey, isn't it, to come to know who that is. Now, this may be just a hint of what the disciples are in for here. Jesus has called them. He has selected them. They have responded. They've followed Him, and they're in and committed. But yeah, they have a long journey to go to figure out what they're in for. Who is this Jesus? And yet, with all of that faltering and all of that slowness and hesitation, all that two steps forward and one step back stuff, the disciples will ultimately believe, all except Judas. They will ultimately believe. And what hope this is for thick-skulled folks like you and me at times, isn't it? Our hearts and minds can be so slow to see who Jesus is and to trust Him for who He is, to trust Him for who He has revealed Himself to be. And He's here to both sympathize with our slowness and to urge us on and challenge us along to a firmer and clearer faith, a firmer and clearer vision of who He is. So this passage both encourages and exhorts us toward that who are believers, but it also warns us. It warns us about something less than biblical faith, which sees Jesus as a helpful passenger on our boat, maybe, but not the sovereign Lord. There's something less than biblical faith where we see Jesus as helpful, but not the Lord. And we must beware this counterfeit false faith. And sadly, this is how many present Jesus in our day. And without necessarily putting it in these words, Jesus is a spiritual booster. Jesus, take the wheel. He can help your relationships, your marriage. He can help your parenting, your self-esteem, your success. He can win your victories. But all that time, at the bottom, most ultimately, he's merely helping you with your stuff. No, friends. When you come to believe in Jesus, you're turning to him as the Lord and the master of all. The Lord of you. The Lord over your entire life. And yes, the Lord over everything that threatens you. Now, maybe you're here or listening online and you don't yet believe in Jesus. Or you're like the disciples. You see yourself in some kind of gray area in between and you're not ultimately sure where you stand with him. Whatever the case and wherever it is that you do stand with him, let me appeal to you. He is the God-man who came to bridge the gap between us and God. Our sin has made us like the wind and the waves, enemies of God, rebellious, unruly, untamed. And amazingly, by the will of God, Jesus came as a servant to put away our sin on the cross and to undo the enmity between us and God and to put away all the destructive effects that our sin has for all of his people. He is remaking everyone who trusts him, and he will one day return to judge his enemies and to remake the world in peace and righteousness. So the big question for you is, where will you stand on that day? Do you trust him? We urge you, come to Jesus. Trust him. Be reconciled back to God in him. So the takeaway for all of us is this: because Jesus is the divine Son of God who rules over nature, we should trust him as such. We should trust him as God and as man. We should follow him and gladly submit our lives under his lordship, under his rule, because he is Lord of all. But there's even more. This passage isn't merely a generic call to faith, but actually a more specific application of one beautiful and very important dimension of faith. And that brings us to our third stage, our third F, which is freedom. Freedom. Faith dispels fear. Freedom. Faith dispels fear. Isn't it interesting to compare verses 40 and 41? Verse 40 says, "And he said to them," the disciples, "why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" Verse 41, "And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" So in verse 40, Jesus rebuked them for their fear, which revealed their lack of faith in him. But then in verse 41, they respond to what he did. It's pretty clear by what they say. They're not responding to his words. They're responding to his actions with what? Fear. And I think it's fair to read the fear in verse 41 as greater fear than they had in the storm. Look at how emphatic Mark is when he says, "They were filled with great fear." Ironic, isn't it? But these are two different fears, and the distinction is very important. The fear in verse 40 is cowardice. It's a bad fear. It's an inappropriate fear. Jesus is saying that if they had trusted him, they wouldn't have feared the storm. But the fear in verse 41 is a good fear. It's not about the storm. It's not directed at the storm. It's directed at Jesus himself. "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" There's something more frightening than the storm now on the scene. And as we saw, this is the kind of stuff that only God can do, and the disciples know it. Now, they've already seen him heal the sick and the lame. They've already seen him cast out demons. They've already heard his preaching. But somehow they haven't quite gotten it at this level that they're getting it now. Could this be God himself? Now, why do I say that that's a good fear? Well, fear is an entirely biblical and appropriate response to God. It's a major theme you see throughout both Testaments. It's one of the central virtues for God's covenant people to fear him. The fear of the Lord is commanded in the law in Deuteronomy 10:12. "And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? But to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him," etc. Fear of the Lord is commended in the wisdom literature. Proverbs 9:10, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." Fear of the Lord is compelled by the prophets, as we hear in Isaiah 8:13. But the Lord of hosts, him you shall honor as holy. Let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. And I think that Isaiah, this quote of Isaiah, really helpfully amplifies for us what it means to fear the Lord. It's a way of honoring him as holy. It's simply the recognition that he is the biggest, scariest, most glorious, and most frightening being in all existence. The fear of the Lord is reverence. It's a trembling before his grandeur, his greatness, his power, his authority, and his word. And if Jesus' calming of the storm reveals that in fact he is God, then fear is exactly the kind of response that's called for. Now let's be honest. Does that disappoint you? Does this bother you? Does the idea of fearing Christ seem to take him far away from us? Does it make him distant? What about Jesus the Good Shepherd? What about Jesus the suffering servant? What about Jesus the prophet, brokenhearted and weeping over Jerusalem? What about Jesus the sympathetic high priest who knows your weaknesses and temptations? Now, it's easy to fall into this error in our thinking about Jesus to create a false dichotomy, a false division. We create two Jesuses. And sometimes we prefer one to the other, or sometimes we kind of switch back and forth between the two. There's the human Jesus who's near, he's imminent. He shares our weaknesses and our limitations. He loves us. He's compassionate toward us. He sympathizes with our weaknesses and struggles. He's the one walking on the pages of the Gospels. But then there's the resurrected Jesus, divine, transcendent God. He's far off. He's glorious. He's majestic. He's awe-inspiring. He rules the universe by his authoritative word. But of course, there aren't two Jesuses, are there? There is one Jesus. And the glory, and what glory it is to see for us, and we must see this, that these are one and the same person. This is the same person. God the Son, as a man, was asleep from exhaustion on that boat. God the Son, as a man, awoke and looked into the wild, terrified eyes of his fearful disciples and had compassion on them. To answer their question, yes, he most certainly did care that they were about to die. And the divine man, Jesus Christ, spoke to the wind and the waves and ruled them. There is only one Jesus Christ. What a deep mystery it is, isn't it? The person of Christ. And the important thing for you and for me is that Christ, the Christ that we fear, is every bit the compassionate and tender-hearted and sympathetic servant we see on the pages of the Gospels. It's the same Christ. So when we say that we are to fear him, it means this: recognizing him as the most majestic and frightening being in all existence, and running to him, hiding in him, in all his glory and majesty and authority. He is your refuge and protector. He has all the care and concern to want to help you, and all of the power and glory to be able to. Christian, this is your Christ. When we trust the Lord Jesus Christ, the divine Son of God, that trust includes fearing him. And that fear, that idea of fear, might strike you and me as a burden or an obligation. And it's true that in a way, reverence is hard work to maintain. It is spiritual work to maintain a heart of reverence. But let me tell you, the fear of the Lord is a most beautiful freedom. The fear of the Lord, Jesus Christ, is the most beautiful freedom. And how does the fear of the Lord set us free? It's by displacing all other fears with the one who is tender-hearted, compassionate, and unshakably God with us. That's literally his title, one of his names, God with us.
When the glorious and majestic Christ is near you and on your side, what can threaten you? What can harm you? There's a motto that Ronald Reagan used to use, but it stretches back in some form all the way back to the Roman Emperor Hadrian. Peace through strength. Peace through strength. And that's yours in Christ. You want freedom from fear? You want to be liberated from fear? Fear the Lord of all, and you'll have peace and security, not in your strength, but in His. Imagine you're out for a walk, and suddenly a vicious dog comes barreling right toward you, ready to tear you apart. How do you feel? How do you feel in that moment? Now let's take that same scenario and add another detail to it. You're walking your deeply loyal pet tiger. How do you feel now? How does that change the equation? It changes it quite a bit, doesn't it? Now, Jesus is not our pet tiger or our pet anything, but He is deeply loyal in His love. And He is more powerful than anything that can threaten you. The exact threat of this passage, a storm, may seem far off to us. Unlike first century Jews, we don't live in the same kind of constant danger from natural disasters. We don't live as close to nature. And though, yes, I'm sure at times we do fear natural disasters, and maybe things like wildlife or wildfires or earthquakes or floods that at various times could scare us. In general, natural disasters don't loom as large over us with the same kind of imminent danger as they did for these pre-modern people. But the same principle applies when we ask ourselves, what sources of chaos and disorder most frighten you? What sources of disorder and unruliness most threaten me? And most of the things we fear have to do with what other people might do, don't they? Now, these last several months have introduced to us a great deal of tumult and uncertainty in our lives. First of all, we have the coronavirus pandemic that's made our lives at the very least inconvenienced, but also greatly uncertain, threatened the economy and many of our livelihoods, strained trust between citizens and authorities. Add to all that the troubles of racism and racial tensions that have cropped up in the crescendo of unrest and even violence in the streets of our cities. And oh yeah, it's an election year. It all adds up to this swirling sense, doesn't it, of chaos and danger at times. Uncertainty. And I'm no prophet, but who knows where the political and social tensions that we're feeling today may lead years down the road. These may be things that you fear at times. These are things that I fear at times. Or maybe the unruly forces that most concern you are a little bit closer to home because of where you are in life right now. It might be relational chaos. It might be disorder in your dearest relationships. Maybe it's a wasting disease that's come to claim you or a loved one. There can be great fear in these things that we have no control over. And as I mentioned, this is the first in a series of three passages where Jesus will demonstrate sovereign authority over different threats. And next week we'll see His authority over Satan's realm. And Lord willing, 2 weeks from now we'll see His authority over disease and death. Because our dangers and threats are indeed numerous, aren't they? But the point here is that the Jesus Christ who walked humbly with His disciples and healed and taught and later went on as a suffering servant to the cross, that same Jesus rules every single detail of every single thing that threatens you. Remember Psalm 107? Remember that it wasn't just God who stilled and calmed the storm. It was God who raised it in the first place. All of the forces that are arrayed against us bow their knee to the sovereign Christ, and they cannot do a thing. They cannot do a thing that His loving heart does not permit. Christian, do you believe this? Will you believe this tomorrow? Will you believe this Tuesday? Will you believe this next time the news punches you in the gut? Will you believe this next time you get that heartbreaking phone call or email or diagnosis? then this isn't merely a one-time decision. This is a constant habit. This is a disposition we put on, a discipline of taking our fears and putting them up against our sovereign Savior and comparing them. Comparing them. How do these things look next to His grandeur, His greatness, His authority? And all of that marshaled toward doing us the greatest good for you and me, His beloved disciples. Jesus Christ, the God-man, rules unruly nature. He rules over every enemy. He rules over every force that threatens the well-being of His people. So our response is twofold. On the one hand, do not fear. On the other hand, only believe. This belief is a trust that embraces all that He is, both a compassionate servant and a mighty sovereign. He's all of that. And Christian, He's all of that for you. Now this belief, as we see in the disciples, it may be weak, it may be faltering, it may be unclear. But keep on pressing to see Him. Keep on pressing to know Him. Keep on pressing to trust this Jesus Christ. This is belief that trembles in reverent fear at His majesty, at His glory. And knowing and feeling all that about Him as we ought to, let's draw near to find in Him the power that dispels all fear. And every enemy that He now rules, He will one day conquer entirely. Never forget, beloved, where the story ends. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more.